Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. Your hosts are Dr. On, board-certified clinical sexologist, and Xander Kagg, licensed clinical social worker. I'm going to turn this over to you, Xander, so you can introduce our guest.
Thank you, On. I am looking forward to this conversation. I know I say that a lot because we have great guests on our show. And today our guest is Tara Sipneksi, and she's going to pronounce it correctly in just a moment because I did a terrible job, I'm sure. Tara is from Ottawa, Canada, and she's been involved in the trans community there since the early 1980s. In 2017, she started the website Trans Ottawa because she wanted to capture the history of trans people in Ottawa. And then in June of 2022, she opened up the Ottawa Trans Library. I found out about the Trans Ottawa Library from Rupert Raj, who was a previous guest very recently on our show. So go and listen to Rupert's episode. But Rupert told us all about Tara and said you have to have her on the show. So welcome to the show, Tara.
Oh, thanks very much. Actually, you got my name pretty well. It's Sipneksi, but that was close.
Okay, thank you. I thought I did a worse job than I did.
No.
Okay, so that's a lot of history. So why don't we just start talking about those early days? Because I'd really love to hear, what was the trans community like in Ottawa in the early 80s? And how were you getting involved, or how did you get involved?
Well, in the early 80s, as a population, we were pretty well invisible. And so it was really difficult to find other trans people. We had no rights. There was a lot of fear in the community of physical violence and so on. And so how do you find other trans people in this environment? There used to be a church that catered to gays and lesbians called the Metropolitan Community Church. I understand it still has some representation in Africa, but I don't think in North America. But anyway, at the time, they would advertise in the classified sections of the newspaper. I still remember the ad. It said, gay, straight, counseling, and a phone number. So I phoned them up one time and I said, you know, does any other trans person got in touch with you? And he told me, actually, quite a few, but all they wanted to do is talk, which was understandable. But there was one person who had left her name. I should say their name, because her name was Sonia, but I think right now she'd probably be regarded as non-binary or gender fluid. Anyway, so I phoned Sonia up, and Sonia knew a few other people. So this would be around 1980. And so at the time, there was a small cabal of us, maybe six, hanging out at Sonia's place. And then we decided, well, let's advertise in the newspaper. So Sonia put an ad in the newspaper, and then we got a lot of calls, but mostly, again, people who just wanted to talk. And then occasionally I would meet them, but they would not leave me their phone number because they were so paranoid, even though I was transparently trans. And so I could never contact them. They were always phoning me up from time to time and asking me if there was anything on that weekend. But it's difficult to organize anything if you can't get in touch with people. And then there was the other group that were what the medical profession like to call true transsexuals, because they were mostly trans women, of course. They were supposed to being passable as cisgender women and were actively trying to get gender affirming care. But when I'd meet them, because I'm 6'2", it would be difficult because they asked me to go to their meetings dressed as a male, and then I could get changed there. And then we would have our meeting, and then I have to change back and then leave. And I couldn't do that, you know, it was just more hiding and stuff. So you can see how fragmented the community was, right? I mean, it was really hard to organize anything when everybody was going their separate ways and for different sort of things. And it was not really a lot of cohesion within the trans community. And it was really hard. And I got very frustrated. We tried to get something going several times, and it wasn't until 1988 when society has shifted just a little bit that I became founding member of Gender Mosaic, and that was finally the start of Gender Mosaic. Gender Mosaic lasted in Ottawa 35 years, which was pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is amazing. 35 years. It's interesting to hear you talk about how in the early 80s, people were hiding and there was violence, because I don't think of Canada in those terms as a place where there might be violence. We just don't hear about it. We hear about about violence within the context of the United States in comparison to the nonviolence of Canada, but prejudice is prejudice. And it might show up. Maybe it's not a gun violence. Maybe it's physical assault with fists or something.
Exactly.
But I wanted to say a little bit about Metropolitan Community Churches only because I was attending Metropolitan Community Churches in the 1980s, and they do still exist. It is international. It's considered a mainline Protestant denomination. For those listening, it was founded in 1968 by Reverend Troy Perry, who was a gay Baptist minister who was defrocked or exiled or pushed out of that church and then started Metropolitan Community Churches. And so I live near Portland, Oregon, and there's a Portland MCC. So they're definitely still all around the United States. So for people who are interested, who are looking for a worship space that is considered, that on their website, it says LGBTQ, there might be other letters and symbols friendly, whereas in the beginning, it was just for gay and lesbian and trans people, right? But now it's extended to their family members. One thing I wanted to have you maybe touch on briefly, unless it takes more time, is you mentioned about how there wasn't a lot of cohesion. People were going their own way, doing their own thing. Did you find that with Gender Mosaic, there was a semblance of, or an actuality of, a cohesion? Because when I look out into the trans community, I don't see cohesion at all.
Oh, yes, definitely. And this was the reason for Gender Mosaic's success, actually. So the person who started it, Judy, was part of the Tri-S, Society of the Second Self, which was, of course, a cross-dressing organization. But we only used Tri-S to attract members. We never followed any of their rules. I mean, from the very beginning, we had TransMed. We had TransMed in the first few months of Gender Mosaic. And we said, yeah, great, come on in. We had everybody. And to my delight, this is what made it successful. And that's why it lasted 35 years. And I think that's probably why I mentioned earlier, there was this subtle shift that happened, which would not have made it possible earlier. So undoubtedly, that's why Gender Mosaic was a success. It was its diversity. And it was that way right up until the end. Although any organization that goes through 35 years has its ups and downs and drought years. And I think one of the reasons it wound down was trans support groups were of a period of time also, it seemed. And now their period has passed for one reason or another. I don't know whether that's really that good a thing. But also because they were around so much, maybe the younger people did not respond so much to the membership that had been around there for a while. And then the membership didn't cater so much, didn't understand younger trans people as much. And so inevitably, after 35 years, it sort of wound down. But the Ottawa Trans Library was actually a beneficiary of that because we had one final blowout party at the library for the Gender Mosaic. And they donated what funds they had left in their bank account, which I believe right now is like $2,500, which was still much appreciated. But it was a fun way to go because I hadn't seen a lot of these people in year. So it was a really fun day.
Yeah, that sounds great. I love those events where we're either celebrating somebody posthumously or they're still around, but they're from the older days.
Yes.
And people get together. I remember in San Francisco, I organized, it was years ago, a birthday celebration for Lou Sullivan. And that brought together a whole slew of people from across the different trans communities of the San Francisco Bay Area. And it was wonderful, right? Because then they would speak about their friendship with Lou or how Lou provided them with resources or everything about Lou. So I'd love to hear about
that. I'm sure that must have been wonderful. A sense of community I found in those kinds of things. We had a similar party for Joanne Law, who was a real pioneer in Ottawa's trans community also when she turned 80. So many senior citizens who hardly get out anymore, they showed up and young people showed up. It was a really cross-generational event and everybody was in such a good spirits. And there was such a feeling of community and love and support, you know. After that event like that, you go home and you're floating on air a little bit because you sort of feel the strength of the community when it happens like that.
Absolutely. Like you, I'm also a person who's very interested in our history and of people and the movement, yet it's not my profession, right? So maybe we could talk a little bit about how it's not just a hobby for you to do archiving, right? That it's a vocation and an avocation. And because of the work that you did, because of your career, right, you lended those skills and that passion for the trans community in Ottawa. So maybe we could just talk a little bit about your process of cataloging or collecting the history, and then what led to the formation of the library, and how you were already in that world of cataloging and archiving.
During the 80s, when we had events, I would keep posters and documents and stuff from this era. And more than on a few occasions, I would ask myself, why are you doing this? Why are you holding on to this? Because I, in the 80s, I could never see a possibility of doing something with this, right? It just was an entirely different era. And yet, I saw a National Film Board documentary on this. It was called Unarchived. And the film is about people who document marginalized communities, preserve the history of marginalized communities. And I particularly like this story about this gay man from Vancouver who started collecting, tearing posters off telephone poles and everything like this. He collected everything. And he had the same question, why am I doing this? Anyway, but he collected such an impressive archive, and now he's getting on years and so on, that the Vancouver City Archives has come calling and asking him to transfer the archives to him. He's my hero. This is what I would have loved to have done, but there were times when I had doubts that I didn't keep everything, but I kept enough anyway that by the 2015 or something, I was thinking about all the people I knew and the contributions they had made and how often trans history gets erased, and I wanted these people to be remembered. Even if they did what would appear to be small things, but they were in the end big things because they moved the community forward. And then I realized, well, I'm probably the person who has to do this because I was there in the early 80s, and I still had some links to people older than me who I looked at as mentors when I was first coming out. And so that's why I started this compiling the history. And then now, because I have these documents and everything like this, I thought, well, maybe if I open up a little space somewhere, there are a few nerds or something, or history buff who might want to know about the community, maybe they would like to come and have a look at all these things. So that was the origins of the Ottawa Trans Library too. Aside from the book collection that I started, I ran the Gender Mosaic Library for a while. And then afterwards, when I published Triple Echo, I did book reviews for that. So by the time the library started, I ended up with only about 200 books. We're up to about 1,100 now. So the collection is constantly growing. These are the origins of this place, the Ottawa Trans Library. So I had these documents, I had these books, and I thought, somebody should see this, especially now when the society has changed enough that this was possible for me to do this.
Am I remembering correctly when we spoke briefly before scheduling this episode that you worked in a library?
Yes, that's right. I was in the Library of the Canadian Museum of Nature. So it had a lovely collection of books, which I really enjoyed. And so I guess that comes naturally to me too. I was also an English major, so books.
I thought I was remembering that correctly. So you thought maybe some nerd or somebody doing research from time to time might pop along. But I know that it was much more successful than that. You want to tell us about that?
Oh, I was naive. I don't know what I was thinking. From the very beginning, we advertised it as a library and community space. The community space became really important. As you know, there's very few places now that you can call a third space without actually having to pay for the pleasure of meeting people, right? And so that's a need in the community that I kind of underestimated. I wasn't really that aware of this. And so from the very beginning, and I should mention that when I opened it up, I was not that fully committed to it until I mentioned it to a few younger people who just thought this was a great idea, and they jumped in with me. I had a ready set of volunteers without even asking for it, right? There was like four, which is really important. So right at the beginning, one of the volunteers said, hey, we should have a board game night. Well, board game night is just so popular now. It's still one of their longest running events, and especially for the demographic, which is late teens, maybe up to late 20s or something, this is a demographic that is very often under attack. So for them to have this space where they can just go and be themselves and with no questions. And what I love about it is it's self-sustaining in the sense that people who have been there for a little while, if they see a newcomer, they make that newcomer feel welcome. They don't say, sit off here in the corner and play your board games over here. They make a very conscious effort of integrating everybody into the thing. But that's a part of the success. guests or the events that we did afterwards. The library is still kind of the soul of the thing. I still get people from time to time. I had this Jewish man who come in and very intense, and I was wondering what he was thinking. But we have a number of books written by Jewish people on the Torah and being Jewish and so on. And he studied those, and he came in. He didn't borrow them. He came in several days in a row and studied them intently. And then we had this great conversation, and he left afterwards. And I thought, that was really great. These are the kind of people that I really like. Our intense researchers came in there to learn, basically. So the two components of this space that are still really important to its success.
Sarah, the four who volunteered to assist you in the early years, what became of them?
One couple was from the States, actually. They were a couple. The one partner was Canadian and studying at the University of Ottawa. And so their partner came up with them, and they came up right during COVID. So they arrived in Ottawa during COVID and spent a few years knowing absolutely no one. And so when Victoria got in touch with me through the Trans Ottawa site, and we met for coffee, and despite our age differences, we got along really well. And so it was to Victoria I mentioned this, and they ran with it. So that original, let's say, four, Victoria and her partner eventually ended up going back to the States. I still see Cassandra from time to time. We go for coffee and everything like this, but she's not directly involved in the library, but we still keep up.
The space that you're occupying, if I remember correctly, you are outgrowing the space and we're looking for, maybe found, a new space, which is pretty exciting when you think about the needing or wanting to expand and it being possible to expand, mm-hmm. right? So are you still looking, or has that already started to happen, that move?
Well, we had an unfortunate incident. We thought we found a place that would have been ideal for us. It was on two stories, and originally we thought we could rent the ground floor, and then it was accessible, which is important to us. The landlord said, oh, well, we're looking to rent both floors at the same time. So that's all through. And then I thought about it for a little while, and I thought, maybe this could be a field of dreams, build it and they will come, a leap of faith here. So I went back to the realtor and I said, we'll rent both floors. And I went to our current volunteers and the board, and suddenly, because when I saw the second floor, all of a sudden the ideas for what we could do with it came rushing in, and the volunteers took a tour of it. Same thing happened. I tried to rent both floors. And then the realtor came back with an offer and saying, oh, well, the landlords now just want an office type environment. And this was really infuriating, because we told them at the outset exactly who we were and what we were going to use the space for. So somebody was not honest with us, whether it was the realtor or the landlords, but the whole thing fell through, just as I had to tell our landlady whether we were renewing our lease or not. And it was particularly infuriating. It took me a while to get off that, because I had seen the possibilities for this space, and I could see it being our headquarters for many years to come. And then we're back where we are, running out of space, and it's not an air-conditioned space. So when we do board game night, for example, which is really popular in the summertime, and it's 30 degrees Celsius or something, this is not a tolerable space. So it has these limitations, and now we're back. And I was really discouraged for a number of weeks afterwards by the way the whole process went and our failure to get this place. But I'm back looking for, even though we renewed our lease, I'm still looking for a good space. It's difficult, you know, because we really want the space to be accessible. We're not very accessible where we are now. And as part of our mandate, we really feel strongly about justice for disabled people too, people with disabilities rather. What's important, but you know, architecture, up until a few years ago, people didn't seem to really think about the people with disabilities that they might have. So there's a lot of buildings that aren't really very accessible. I did see another one briefly, because I asked my landlady, because she's been really good to us, I have to get that in, whether she had any properties around. And coincidentally, she did. And I thought, oh, great, this would be like a seamless transition and everything. But I went to see it, and it wasn't really very accessible. To get in, you'd have to go up a parking lot and down an alley to get into the back door. And then through the back door, there's another hallway to get into the place. And it's a bit of second-class citizen for me, you know. So that one fell through too, unfortunately.
Thank you. We will be taking our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Keg, and our guest this hour is Tara Sipniewski, whose journey of trans activism took place in the early 80s to opening the Ottawa Trans Library in 2022. Let's take a quick commercial break. We are always grateful to our sponsors and therefore grateful to play their commercials. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Keg. And our guest is Tara Sipniewski. Let's get back to the show.
Unless you could reframe it as the glory days of the speakeasies where you snuck in. But really, it's technically accessible, but it does make somebody go way yes. out of the way. That's unfortunate. Yes. Yeah.
But where we are now is one of the reasons I did rent the place where we are now is we are on Main Street, Ottawa. We are at the barbershop next door and the flower shop just down the street. And that's what makes it so great. People just walk by. The very first time we opened up for the first month or so, people would be walking by and I would suddenly see their heads craning around to see the sign saying Ottawa Trans Library as if, did I read that right? It was a measure of disbelief that something like this would be sitting there on Main Street, Ottawa. It's really great. I always got a chuckle out of that, you know. But now we're really integrated in the neighborhood that we're in. I mean, everybody's been so supportive. The businesses in the neighborhood have been so supportive and everything. So it's a really good community. And that's very difficult to move out of too, right? But it's also because it's such a good community, it's become a little more gentrified. And because it's gentrified, the rent's going up. And so it might be difficult to find a space within where we are.
Pros and cons. Yeah.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that magic couldn't be sustainable.
Exactly. I can't say enough about the neighborhood where we live in. I actually lived there in the early 1980s. I had no job, no income, and I had this dumpy apartment about 4 blocks from where this library is now. But I discovered, much as I hated where I was in my life and my dumpy apartment, that I really liked the neighborhood. It was, even back then, it was a very real neighborhood. There was no pretense about it. And even so many more years when I was deliberating whether to rent the space, I walked around and I said, it's still Hindenburg. It's still the same feel to it. And it felt like closing the circle on my life to come back to Hindenburg. And it was a very good decision.
It's very cool. If you're interested, we could talk about some of your personal journey because we've been talking a lot about your engagement in community. You let us know if that's something you'd like to include in talking about your own journey. Just as a trans person or just in general, right? Just your life journey.
Sure. So I mentioned my dumpy apartment in Hintonburg, and that was the culmination of some difficult period in my life where I could not see very much future for myself. So I'm 6'3", so I'm clearly not going to be passable as a cisgender woman and broad shoulders and deep voice and so on. And so at the time in the 1980s, there was absolutely no gender-affirming care for a person like me. So it was literally sink or swim. Well, I knew people who sank, unfortunately. I've lost some friends because of that awful period of time. So, but as I tell people, when I ended up on Irving Avenue in Hindenburg, I discovered, because I kept on quitting jobs because I was suffocating. But as I tell people, it's tough to be trans, but it's really tougher to be trans and poor. So I thought, no, next job I get, I'm going to hold on to anyway. I'm going to try to make it work and stuff. And by chance, what rescued me was that I got a job with the National Museums of Canada, which aligned with my interests. Even the precise job that I had there didn't, but at least the department did. So I held on to that with the hope that they would eventually transfer me to the library, which is what I was constantly requesting. And that eventually happened. And I could finally find a little breathing room because I was at least amongst things that I enjoyed and had a passion for. And there was less office politics. You're in a library. You have time. You can wander the stacks and nobody questions you why you're over there, right? If you're having a bad day, go into the library books and stuff. Anyways, then Gender Mosaic started and so on. And I found more of a community and stuff. And so I learned to cope better with the circumstances. By the time of transition and everything like this, I had gotten to the point where I thought, almost why bother? I'm living this way. And what would happen being a visible trans woman, those usual fears about that kind of thing, because you don't know until you live it. I've learned how to cope and I've had a pretty good life, but the coping is not living. So that's when I went ahead and I transitioned. But I still went in with it with this long history of being rebuffed when I went to a therapist. And my impression was that she would always try to dissuade me from it. So my first few sessions, I was talking with her and I realized, I know more about this than she does. What am I here for? And it suddenly occurred to me about the third session in, she's just waiting for me to say, I'm ready. And so this third session, I said, well, I'm ready. And she jumped into action. She was working with a psychiatrist. Psychiatrist made an appointment with me. And then the psychiatrist could prescribe hormones, of course. And so that was the beginning of my journey. But it's funny because it was so ingrained into me after a lifetime of rejection and not being able to do this that I went into it thinking that I can't do this. And then it was a real revelation to find that I could. And to be honest, for some strange reason, maybe it's because my age or something and or my personality or something like this, I get fairly good vibrations when I meet people in the communities. I was a little bit wary because I thought, visible trans woman, how am I going to be treated? But it's been good. I haven't had any transphobic incidents whatsoever.
Really great to hear. I've described a feeling of walking around with a suit of armor on because I was always expecting, because I had so often experienced some sort of negative response to my masculinity, right, as a woman. And so I carried that in with me into the first couple of years of my transition because it's not easy to just sort of let that go. It almost felt like it would be stupid to do that, right? Because then I wouldn't be cared or ready, right? I had a sense of hypervigilance about it in the way that we would talk about somebody with post-traumatic stress, right? And so it makes sense then to go into a therapeutic relationship or speaking with a therapist, especially in the earlier days of things, because we started to call them gatekeepers, but that wasn't until much later, right? They kind of did. They held the keys. They were the ones who wrote the letters. They were the ones who told us who we could go on to next because they knew the channels into these clinics and these providers. So there was a sense that we had to do what they wanted or act how they wanted. We saw that in that movie Transamerica, if you remember. The therapist was like, I don't know if you're ready, right? She was like holding it, holding that over the main character. And it's that kind of experience that a lot of people have had, or they've heard about it from others, that that was the experience.
Yes, I talk with people my age, and we laugh about it now, but it was just so ridiculous. Is that we got to know what they were expecting. We got to know what they wanted to hear. So then we started telling them what they wanted to hear. And then they figured out that we were catering our answers to what they wanted to hear. And so the whole process became a whole bunch of lies. There was no truth in any of it, right? But it was all this game that we were playing to try to get gender-affirming care. It was just so ridiculous. And we sort of laugh about it now, but it was not fun at the time at all.
No, and what's really interesting to me is that a lot of the tell them what they want to hear and how that spread through the community. But now we know people were just saying what they had to say. It wasn't necessarily true for them, right? And they would use tropes like born in the wrong body, which wasn't really how somebody felt, but they had to say it because that was what was expected. But nowadays, it seems that that has become absolute gospel. Born in the wrong body is now coming back with a vengeance and is one of the almost like one of the chants, one of the mainstream arguments. Born in the wrong body. You do realize people were just saying that and didn't literally mean it. But now people literally mean it.
Yes.
Well, especially because politically, there have been a lot of changes introduced. When we talk about hypervigilance and that description, I'm constantly monitoring what is backed up as truth versus does it just fall away and then we're left hanging with, well, what happened to that bit of information? And recently, I think I sent it to you, Xander, this discussion removing 1,000 driver's licenses, not necessarily revoking them, of individuals, and I can't remember the state because I read gobs and gobs of
Kansas.
Yeah, thank you, of information. Whatever happened to that, I have no idea. But what goes through my mind is that once something like that is introduced and it's accepted and then it's pushed forward, other states look at that and then they want to follow suit in the same way. And so I'm actually concerned about the political landscape, particularly where I live in Florida and Xander lived in Florida. Xander, I can't really speak for you, but I don't think your area where you lived was quite like the area where I live. And I love my neighborhood. I love my neighbors. I can't speak ill of anyone in my location, but it's not the same climate by any means. It's very different. But it was going to be my question to you. How is all that affecting Canada?
Well, I think there's always the far-right threat is looms, but so far we've been able to battle back. I mean, we've had a tremendous amount of support from the community for the Auto Trans Library that I'm really grateful for. And you know what I've learned? Well, I learned this a long time ago, I think probably, was that when we limit these definitions of a wrong body and so on, is that it takes away from the diversity in the trans community, which is really one of its amazing things. But you know, when we were all invisible so many years ago, I thought everybody was going to be like me, which is far from the truth, which is when I discovered Gender Mosaic, when we had all these diverse trans people coming in. I thought, wow, this is really amazing. This is really wonderful. It was a learning experience, you know. I think that generally speaking, I mean, we had in Ontario, anyway, Bill 33, which was passed in 2012, which included gender identity and gender expression is in the Ontario Bill of Human Rights. So then on the federal level, Canadian level, Bill C-16 passed in 2017. And that had the same purpose. It was to prohibit harassment, discrimination on the basis of gender expression and gender identity. And so I feel that the legislation is really important to lead. It doesn't necessarily mean that society changes overnight, but and the legislation is there. It makes a big difference. So you can actually apply for a job at being trans and get one. So it's led to more openness in the community also, and more openness. People outside of the community meet you and say, well, this is a nice person. I think it has a ripple effect. And where I live in particular, in Ottawa, it's a good place for trans people in general, I would say. So I facilitate Parents' Night at the library. When I was young, I met a lot of young trans people who were thrown out of the house for being trans. So it's just, for me, so wonderful to meet these parents who absolutely love their kids and would go to the wall for them. But anyway, one time, actually, they've become fairly regular. There's parents from the UK who have actually emigrated to Canada. They feared for their trans daughter, and they didn't think it was going to be a very good environment for her. They had the opportunity to emigrate, and they took it, which is really You know, the sacrifices involved in doing that, it's not easy to just up your life and move across the ocean. But they did that for their daughter, and that just touches me. Like, you wouldn't believe it. Having grown up with beating young trans people who got thrown out of the house for it, it's like a world change.
There's so much around the language that gets used around. So, for example, to go back a little bit to what happened in Kansas, right? One of the states here in the United States, because we have an international audience. It was something like 1,800 people had changed their driver's license, the sex that's marked on their driver's license in Kansas, because not all of the states permitted you to change your sex marker on your state IDs or driver's licenses, some until pretty recently, right? So the fact that there were 1,800 tells you they were probably, Kansas came online a lot later than like California did, where I was living at the time when I changed mine. And so that is a small number of people being affected. The other issue, people have asked me, they said, if it was happening to me personally, like, Xander, what would you do if all of a sudden you got a driver's license in the mail, or even a passport, right? Because we've had this on the national level here about passports. And those things, you were told you have to get rid of your old one. This is your new one. And there's an F on it, but still my name, right? I legally changed my name. They're not going to change my name back, right? But they could, at the national level, at least, California is not going to do it, but at the national level, they could reissue my passport. And it'd have an F on it. And they said, what would you do? And I said, well, I'd keep it in my little safety deposit box thing. And then I'd pull it out when I traveled. What else am I going to do? Like, I'm not going to let it ruin my life. I'm not going to make a big stink about it. I'm going to wait until it changes again, because it changes. We couldn't get them. And then we could get them. And then we couldn't. And we will again. And so I feel like I would just ride it out. And I know trans men in particular who have Fs on their passports, because they've never changed them, and they travel freely all over the place. And so I'm not an anxious person, and I'm not a person who feels a lot of trepidation and worry and concern and fear. So I would just take it in stride. Like, it wouldn't bother me. I wouldn't feel like I was being erased or eliminated, or there's a lot of words that get used. And I personally, I don't find it very helpful to frame things in those ways, using language of war and genocide. I think it might be backfiring. I think people are hyperbolic and we're overreacting. And I don't want to give them more fuel for that. Because earlier, Terry, you used the word about how trans history and the people in trans history, you used the word erased. I replace erased in my head with just lost or forgotten. I don't know that people are intentionally removing our history from the history book, so to speak. There's just so much history that can be told. There's so many people that are not LGBT that we'll never know about. I don't know that their history was erased. I just think, who catalogs it and who gets to see what they've cataloged, right, in archives? So is it erased or is it just lost? I think the meaning of those two terms is different enough that it affects how we live. I live in the world of it's lost, so I'm not upset and angry and needing to feel like I have to fight all the time. If people feel it's been erased, it's going to motivate them to engage in a way that I consider to be not well for people. Our emotional, our physical, our mental, our social well-being, I think, is negatively impacted by people who want to fight injustice versus the people who want to work towards progress. Does that make sense?
We will be taking our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg, and our guest this hour is Tara Sipniewski. Don't go away. We'll be back shortly.
Radio. UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Kegg. And our guest this hour is Tara Sipniewski. Let's get back to the show.
Sure. Erased is like an active verb, but I would say it happens through neglect and not wanting to engage with the community. And so society has other priorities where they're going to record people that they find more of value, then our history just gets lost for sure. I think a lot depends on how you feel. Like I'm not a passable cisgender woman, but it doesn't change how I feel about myself. And so you have to have strength about how you feel about yourself to address how society interacts with you. In a way, actually speaking to your previous comment about armor, I know who I am, and that's my armor in a way. And it suits me well, because the interesting thing about that is that some people are extremely perceptive. I have women friends who, after I transitioned, our relationship changed, and we're a lot closer now. And it's as if they've seen me the way I see myself. Other people do not see this, but that's okay. I still know who I am, and that's my strength.
Yeah, I think it's that external validation or affirmation that's become quite common, right? Mm-hmm. The expectation, my family will accept me, my family will affirm me. Well, maybe, hopefully.
Yes.
But I read somewhere recently, somebody said, it's another trans guy that I know, his name is Gray Doolin. We interviewed him recently, but the episode hasn't aired. By the time people are hearing yours, it will have aired. So go and listen to Gray's episode. But he posted something on Substack just the other day. He has a site there called Unshakable. And if you're waiting for the world to change, for you to feel better about who you are and your place in the world, you're going to be waiting a long time.
Absolutely.
Right? So that external affirmation is really beautiful and wonderful when we get it. But if we require it, if we demand it, people don't like that. Right? Change is inevitable, but people don't like to be forced to change. And I think this is one of those where it's coming up for us in our community that's like, you must use these words. You must refer to me in this way. You must believe everything I say about who I am and rearrange in your brain everything you've been taught since middle school about biology, right? And anatomy. I don't think it's going well for us, that particular type of movement making, because I think a lot of people are either looking for or needing or requiring an external validation or affirmation because they're not so sure about themselves, which makes sense. In lieu of seeking it externally, how can we build it for ourselves internally in our own bodies and our own understandings of ourselves? What are the avenues for that? Who's doing that? Who's popularizing that idea? I'd love to see more of that.
But, you know, we still live within society, right? And so we're still affected by people's reactions to us and so on. What I've really discovered and cherish is the support and understanding from the LGBTQ plus community here in Ottawa. Whenever I get together with them, there is no separation between who I am and how they see me. I meet people who say, oh, they accept me, but there's a gap between their understanding of who I am and what they think it is. And so I really just wanted to speak in support of finding people like that. And that really helps you to have a stronger sense of yourself because you're around people who get you right away. And I found this really one of the strengths of the Ottawa Trans Library is that I've had this opportunity to enrich my life by meeting these people and they've become part of my life.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. It's like those concentric circles. There are people on the outside of the circle that are indifferent or hostile or insensitive or whatever it is. And then it gets closer closer and closer to you. People are friendly and they're nice and they use the right terms, but they don't really comprehend. And it gets right. closer and closer. And so I think you're right, because we live in the world. And so we just need to be aware of where people are in our circles of comfort with them and them with us. Mm-hmm. So that we can maybe make decisions then about who we're going to spend the most time with or where we're going to spend the most time, because we're all going to have to go to the grocery store or the bank or whatever, but maybe we do those things in certain neighborhoods. We do what we need to do to create a sense of comfort and safety and belonging.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've talked a lot about the Trans Ottawa Library and Gender Mosaic. I know that Gender Mosaic doesn't exist anymore, but is it still available online for people to learn about it? Where can people learn about all the wonderful things that Gender Mosaic did for 35 years? And then also, where can people find out more information about Trans Ottawa and anything else that you'd like people to go and look at, websites or social media channels?
I believe all the newsletters for Gender Mosaic, which was Notes from the Underground, which I also started. They're all on the Transgender Digital Archive, a number of other publications also. And then the Trans Ottawa site is transottawa.ca, and it's on the history page. A lot of the Toronto trans history is Gender Mosaic initiatives over the years. And I always think that the fact that it's been around for 35 years, it was also a really big ripple effect that made Ottawa a more trans-friendly place, because you didn't have to be an activist in those 35 years. All you had to do is they joined Gender Mosaic, and they've compelled to tell their friends or tell their parents or come out and everything like this. And that ripple effects extended out over the community. And I really think that underappreciated part of Gender Mosaic is the fact that it was around for 35 years. And it was so many people went through their doors in 35 years, and they had that ripple effect on the community. And it was a positive one.
That's really wonderful. And is there anything coming up for you that you want to share?
I've been trying to step back from the library a bit, just because I've been so entangled with it for so long. But that's kind of difficult. I've been keeping a journal since I was 17, which has now grown into ridiculous proportions. But there's a lot of trans history in there also. People want me to donate the entire thing, and I don't know exactly what to do with it, because it becomes a problem after a while. Mae West once said, at first you keep a journal and then it keeps you, which is basically what's happening to me now. But I'd like to do something with this. I've been going through the past pages, and there's some really good parts of it, actually, that are enlightening for even to me, that I've forgotten about trans history, about my personal experiences through the years. Because I'm a Virgo, somewhere around 2000, I decided I'd read it from start to finish. And then when I was doing that, I thought, oh, I'll make an index. So I have an index now of this really big thing, which has been really useful for me to go back to look at specific subjects through. So I'd like to do something with this mammoth journal that I've created. I'm also thinking of Trans History of Ottawa to make a book out of it, because there's all sorts of documents and visuals that I could add to it and add certain things that would probably make it a decent book. Anyway, so these are the kind of things. It's like going back to my English major days more.
Yeah, I hope that those projects do get up and running and off the ground. And ultimately, there is a book, and whatever you can do with that journal, maybe get that published or do something about it. That all sounds really wonderful. And if you have movement in those areas, we'd love to have you back on to talk about what you're doing sure. in the future. We definitely would love that. But we'd love having you on the show. So thank you so much, Tara, for coming and talking to us today about
Thanks very much. It's been an interesting conversation.
Appreciate it. We have come to the end of the Umbrella Hour. Until next time, thank you for listening.